everyone. Welcome to the VFX Essential Crisis Podcast. Again, an early morning record, so the words are coming out slowly. Today we wanted to talk, we asked everybody for input, all of the hundreds of you that out there that are listening, psychos.
The tens.
Yeah, the tens of hundreds of you. Thanks for listening. And we asked, okay, what would everyone like to hear about from us? And I think bidding was mentioned at least twice. So we took that initiative and ran with it. So I think we might do this in a couple sections because bidding is such an important part of what we do. And as in VFX and animation and really any kind of contract service work. So I was thinking we would start with, I think, something that maybe people don't get as much exposed to, which is the sort of philosophy of bidding. And that is different in every studio. It's different in every, it's a little different in every industry. But it might help give you a context for some of the interactions. If you're an artist on a daily basis, you're like being asked, how long is this going to take you? That's often leads to a bid or compares to a bid. Mm-hmm. And like we were talking about last week, the number one of the number one complaints that everyone has, rightly or wrongly, is like, oh, the client sucks. And we talked a little bit how we feel about that and how that's a bit of a cop-out in my opinion. But the next most popular one, or maybe even more popular, is this is under bid. which could be true. But some of that depends on the context in which you look at it. So I thought it would be good to talk about that. I have talked about it with a lot of studios. As you come in as a producer or a VFX supervisor, you have to sort of start to understand like what's their plan, what's their breakdown of costs, what's their philosophy, and try to fit into that philosophy and, you know, produce something that makes sense to the client, but also makes sense to the studio. And that's actually, I think, an underlooked part of the job of the project team, is to create a framework that makes sense to the client and the studio. Because sometimes the studio is the harder part, honestly, especially if it's a bigger studio or an entrenched studio. So, Graham, you... being more closer to the clients on the business side, especially at the initial kind of stage, I imagine you have a different perspective on this than me. For me, I more have to translate some kind of action into a plan. But one of the first things I was thinking about is, I think it's important for people to understand like the business motivation of a particular bid. Like, is this an established relationship we have? Are we trying to win a new client? Are we willing to eat a little bit of the cost because we're desperate for the work? Are we fully busy? Should we, you know, up the cost? Like, I don't know if you have any kind of thoughts or perspective on that.
Yeah, there's almost two different waveforms, if you want to think of it that way. There's like the studio capacity and need, and then there's the client studio capacity and need. And so it actually creates a really interesting dynamic, because when things were busy in that sort of post-COVID, pre-strike year where everything was bananas, you could charge an actual proper day rate for your shot and actually get paid. Like, it was actually pretty reasonable. The studios hated it because they felt that they were being taken advantage of. But for the first time ever, the demand for VFX outstripped the supply, and so you could keep your prices high, which has created an interesting phenomenon, because now the exact same shots that we bid in that window, let's say 20 grand, would probably today go out at 10 grand. And why is that? It's because there's an overcapacity in VFX still. We've seen a lot of studio closures, and but still the amount of work doesn't fill what's left. So there's still a lot of bidding. And this is where the studio side comes in, the vendor side studio comes into play. It's like, I have 80 artists sitting around doing nothing. Am I better to take a gig to keep the lights on, mm-hmm. And reduce my prices for that, or am I going to hold firm? And it's a tough choice, because on the one hand, you'll get revenue in if you take a job, but you might not get profit. And we've probably seen that happen time and time again, right? Where people take a job and they can massage the numbers on paper to look like there's going to be something left at the end of the day. But you get a round of client notes, there's a push in the schedule, there's an extension, and suddenly you're holding the bag for a lot of changes. And one of the other consequences of there being an oversupply of competition is you don't have a lot of leverage anymore. It used to be that you could have a conversation with your client and say, hey, this is a change order. You know, we're going to, or you've delayed, we need a holding fee for the crew that you've sabotaged for a month. You know, you used to be able to get those things, but now literally they'll say, well, I'll take it across the street. They'll do it for 85 cents of the dollar. And so you end up stuck in these scenarios where you have the best of intentions. You could have pulled it off perhaps if everything has gone perfectly, but as we know in VFX, that almost never happens. So
the artist on the floor, which is, I think, most of our audience at this point, is obviously would be kind of annoyed by this notion, sure. Right? But it's the same thing that happened when you could walk out of a studio and go to the next thing. It's pure capitalism, supply and demand, whether you like it or not. It's a function of our lives and our business. So it's easy to say, well, we should hold our ground and we should do all this kind of stuff. But when you're responsible for the 100 people that are going to lose their jobs, that's a lot of pressure to get that bid. I've seen a lot of people, including myself, I've experienced this as well, where you talk a big game when you're not responsible, but then as soon as you're put in that position, you do the exact same things that you were criticizing. Partly because you understand why they were doing them. Maybe, especially at the beginning, you maybe should hold your nerve a little bit more. But it's a lot harder than people think. And so if you're an artist out there and you've freelanced, it's a very similar position. It's the exact same position, just maybe at scale. It's like the goal of bidding is to estimate the job so the company makes money and the client's pays it. And that's the key thing. So it's this kind of guessing game of like, how much will they pay for this and how much will it cost me? And that goes across every industry that does any bidding. If you've renovated your house or anything, it's the same thing. It's just some of the expected norms are different. Like if you renovate your house and it goes over, they charge you. Because you're screwed without them.
You don't get to do your kitchen in red that decided the last minute you want a blue and expect it to happen for free.
You know? Well, even if it's their fault, you still end up paying for it because you have a hole in your wall. That sometimes works in movies, but there's often other people to fill the hole. So anyway, so that's, I think it's important for everyone to sort of understand that pressure. And I think different companies deal with it differently. Like when you said you may have to, you know, or you're bidding it really lean to try to get it, or sometimes you're literally bidding it at a loss. The effect on the crew can be different, right?
So, yeah, I mean, I can say that, like, I've been through some pretty extraordinary times. I mean, just in my time at Cinesite, we had the pandemic and then the strikes. And so really a volatile window and visual effects all around. And, you know, there's two pressures on a manager, right? Like there's the fiduciary duty, the obligation you have to your ownership group to do the best with their money and investment as possible. Cause that's the job is to, you know, people forget, like they think that there's like buckets of money. Most of these studios are privately owned and run on a very shoestring budget with individual investors. Of course, these are typically wealthy individuals, but still it's their money that's funding everything. Yeah. So there's a responsibility on management to do the best possible. And then on the other hand, there's the crew who, you know, you feel an obligation. I mean, if you're a good manager, you feel an obligation to protect and keep busy. And so I can speak about Cinesite because this is not confidential or anything. I mean, I had to pitch to them the shows that I wanted to take. Typically, they didn't approve every individual bid, of course, but like if I wanted to take a bid for a strategic purpose, let's call it, mm-hmm. I would have to run it up the chain. I'd have to get approval. So like during COVID, there were some jobs that were clear losses, but we knew that in order to be a functioning visual effects studio, we needed our core team. And our core team was, I think, 65 people we identified. And so we took a job that kept 30 of them paid, and the other 30 we just sort of carried. But it was, everyone understood it was an offset. Like it was not going to solve the problem, but it was going to mitigate a really bad situation.
Sometimes you'll take that because you, even in busier times, you might take a job like that because you want that client.
Sure. I got, that's a big one. Like when we started, when I started CineSite, we had, you know, pretty much Netflix was our major client. Mm-hmm. But the problem with having one client is that if you mess up, it can cascade through your other shows. Because generally you might have different production teams, but they all go to the same exec at the end of the day that are approving your budget overages and everything else. And then, you know, if they lose confidence, then that's terrible. And also they can withhold work. So part of the initial strategy was to diversify the portfolio of clients, you know, have four or five clients that, you know, you could kind of rotate through if necessary. So for sure, when you're in that stage of expanding, you want to be price competitive for sure.
I've been in a situation where I took a job because we had a prior relationship with the customer and it was clearly going to be probably a money loser. I mean, that's an interesting framework too, because there's different levels of that analysis. So at the project level, maybe it's a money loser. And that's where a lot of energy is focused because that's the unit of measurement that we're using. But maybe overall, it's not so bad business-wise. And, you know, you can almost treat it like a marketing expense at that point. If we lose $50,000 on this in the project, maybe it's, you know, like you say, it retains people. Maybe the studio grows or pays for some other technology costs that are going. Because that's the other thing I think people forget too is there's labor costs, which is a huge component of VFX, but there's also like the hard costs, like the computers still are on, you know, getting paid off and the electricity is getting paid. So if you don't keep the machine moving, you're losing money. So it's sort of a losing proposition if you turn the job down or if you take the job. The weird kind of rule of truth though, is often when you take the low job, it's always the worst job.
Oh yeah, that's almost a truth. It's like the less money the client has, the more of a pain they're going to be. Almost guaranteed.
It's not always that way, but it's pretty consistently so.
Yeah.
So so what I was going to get to, the effect on the crew of that can be different. So, and that depends on your management, your leadership, but not just the project leadership, but the business leadership. So I have worked in situations where that pressure and responsibility has been handed down, trickled down to the project team, like do this project for 10%, 20% less than you should. And it's not a bad exercise. It's not a comfortable exercise, but it's not a bad exercise every once in a while. It does sort of push innovation sometimes. But like anything like that, you have to be, again, paying attention when you've pushed too far and you're breaking everyone. Because it's surprising, like the complaints might be true. This is too low. This is too hard. But funny, a weird thing happens is that you actually get it done. Could it have been better? Could it have been a better experience? Yes. But often you learn things out of those more challenging situations than you would out of the sort of ideal situation. The other way is that the management absorbs that responsibility and they give you a project budget that makes sense.
Right.
That is bit more rare because if you think about it, it makes sense. Like it's the most fair, quote unquote fair, but it's also kind of hiding the reality of it. So, you know, when I've been in that situation, it's like, okay, I understand, but I still, for me, it was good to know that that project was a little underwater, even though I knew I could spend up to that and not, you know, piss off my bosses. But now knowing that and having the crew know that, if we can push a little faster and a little harder, it's going to help the company and then eventually our jobs. Now, not all of that information, especially in bigger studios, doesn't get down because they're and this is a message to artists, they protect you a lot from information because they think that you can't handle it.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it makes sense because you have a different job to do, right?
Yeah. But, yeah, I have lots of comments on that. So, like, before we move on to the nitty-gritty, yeah, which I think is important, like, the another strategic reason that I've seen us take jobs was to advance the skill set of the studio. So, for example, what separates a comp shop, and there's nothing wrong with a comp shop, by the way, from a 3D shop is animation, fur, rigging, crowd, all those sort of technical skills.
Yeah.
And so we've taken jobs that, you know, allowed us to hire more animators or allowed us to hire more Houdini artists.
You know, those departments.
You know, those sort of unique departments where the skill set is very unique. Not every show requires it. So, you know, you might be busy, but you might not have a lot of effects work. And so you might take a few shots from a small project that you're going to lose money on because Houdini and effects is generally pretty expensive and a bit of a black box, but it keeps those people working. And then getting back to the nitty-gritty stuff, like, people need to be aware that, like, we bid from an imperfect system. We have perhaps some storyboards, maybe there's some early shots, but we're bidding the best we can, and we're in the back of our minds, we know we're bidding against everybody else on the planet. So the best producers are the ones that take the information at the end of the day and then kind of look at the bid as an envelope and then reallocate where they think the tasks are required. Because I think that's when they have they get their dailies footage in, they've seen a lot more, they know a lot more, they have the flexibility to sort of allocate that stuff out a second time with a second set of eyes. I think that's been, our most successful projects have people who do that.
Yeah, that's my experience as well. I am one of those people who likes to do that. And when I can't do that, I feel like I don't have agency. And then it's sort of like, okay, well, it'll be what it'll be. But on that note, one trend that I've seen, so I'm about to go on a rant here. Look out. So bidding is an imperfect, as you said, process. And I don't care. You said, because of VFX, we don't have the place, we have storyboards, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, sure. That's true. But in animation, it's the same imperfect process. And they're making every single thing that they do. They're essentially, to a large extent, in control of what they're... But this is a subjective, creative process with potentially hundreds of people involved. So the chance that it will go perfectly is ridiculously slim.
Very.
So to go into it thinking that you can mathematically calculate the exact outcome before is ridiculous. And this, I think, comes from companies getting bigger and the financial side of things, the financial people trying to impose that metric on this process, which logically makes sense. And I'm not saying they shouldn't, but when, you know, one of the biggest problems I've had in the last 5 years is explaining to accountants and finance people that this is not a manufacturing line as much as you would like it to be. Mm-hmm. Maybe some components of it might be. And you can do things to make it more predictable. And that's a lot of what we do, right? Pipeline is essentially that. Outsourcing is essentially that. Hiring experienced people is essentially that. You know, the AI conversation is essentially that. How can, or any tool development, how can you, you know, reduce complexity? And really what you're doing is creating predictability. And that's what every business owner who has to sign off on a bid is freaking out on whether, is this $1 million contract going to make me money or lose me money? That's pretty worrying.
Yeah.
And it's not like there's a high profit margin in visual effects and there's a lot of variable costs. So, but the trend towards like the perfection trap, I call it, I've seen it, like friends of mine who are owners of studios have told me that this is what they want to do. And I'm like, what are you doing, man? Like, it's crazy to think that you're going to be able to mathematically figure out a project and have it run perfectly. Like, essentially what they're trying to do is take all the human thinking out of the process. So animation tried to do this a lot. Mm-hmm. At scale, you can do large components of it. And this is why everything got segmented into departments. So it becomes very predictable and stuff. But now it's all coming back towards a more generalist thing, which makes it even more hard to predict. But this idea that you can, you know, go, well, this is exactly 0.25 days in this thing. And then
it's
like, sure. Come on.
The thing is, though, like, I mean, I've seen different people in the same studio bid the same job vastly differently. And so if you let a VFX supervisor bid a job, they want to account for every possible change they could ever want to make. And the days balloon like crazy.
That's usually when you give it to artists, you get the, and it's all, again, it goes to my philosophy of everything is anxiety oriented in visual effects.
Totally. So I want studio I was at, they wanted the departments to have input on every bid, which was ridiculous because every department manager just imagines the worst possible case scenario, and every bid for every shot became like this Herculean task. It was ridiculous. But then you give it to a salesperson whose job is to close business, and suddenly the days disappear, your overhead disappears, you know, margin looks great.
You have no CG supervisor on the show.
Yeah. You get a 0.5 visual effects supervisor, right? Like, I mean, honestly, the truth is always somewhere in the middle. And one of the tools for success that we started using was like looking back at our actual performance. Like we look at our inventory of driving comps and we can tell over time, you know, it took a day and a half to do an average driving comp, and a complex driving comp might take 2 full days and a super hard one would 2.5. And by kind of referencing back to actual work done in the studio, it took some of the guesswork and the human error out of it because, you know, if you have enough data, it sort of averages out over time.
Which is,
I think, a useful trend and probably something AI can help with going forward, like taking bid actuals and bid days in the bid and sort of comparing to see where we've overbid and underbid certain tasks.
Yeah, I'm not against the idea of all that. In fact, I'm very data driven in general. However, I feel like what's missing is the piece that people use their brains, you know what I mean? So, it's always amazing to find an HR person who understands more about what we do. It's always amazing to work with a finance person who understands more about what we do. I imagine it's the same for them. Like, I try to make an effort, having done HR type stuff and finance stuff to a lesser extent, to reach out and make and share information, so that everyone has a context. Because otherwise, again, I think as things have gotten segmented, these silos kind of start up, and then people don't really understand what we do. And that works both ways.
Oh, for sure. And it's I've worked with some really phenomenal accountants like Mathieu and Veronique, and like Vero was there before I got there. So she was like the expert and was like educating me on how they did their day recognition, revenue recognition. And then when Mathieu came in, like for I don't want to call it an average accountant, but for someone who's like used to making widgets or something, this very fluid, service-oriented business where clients have so much power, it's almost incomprehensible to an accountant, right? It's like, what the hell are you telling me? Like, they promised they were going to pay today, and you know, now the show has moved 6 months. Like, how do we recognize that?
I learned this on the wild, like I was working with the data wranglers and the render wranglers, and they just thought of usernames and machines. This guy, oh my God, he's killing the farm. And I'm like, okay, come here. And I grab him and I take him downstairs and I go, can you show us that shot? And they'd show us the shot. And I'm like, that's why it's taking 100 hours to render. And he's like, oh, you know what I mean? So that early learning, it's like, I'm obsessed with soccer right now because of the World Cup, but it's like, you have to learn the other people's positions so you understand your own position better. And I think,
That's hard in a big studio for sure. Because there's a risk of over segmenting the teams for sure.
But there is a drive for certain owners and management to want to be able to create the perfect bid at the entry point and have it never change.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the dream, but I just don't think it's practical or realistic.
In animation, it's maybe a bit more possible because, but it's not, practical. And then the other thing too is, like you said, like often there's this bidding producer or it's just early in the process. It may be the same people, but it's just early in the process and you don't really have the full understanding of what everyone's doing. And plus the client is adapting on the fly too, and they're thinking about their process and all that kind of stuff. So the idea that your initial, it's the classic, like your plan won't survive contact with the enemy. There's so much evidence of this in the world, in war, in visual effects, in animation, in business. Yeah. I don't understand why. I understand striving for that. That makes sense. But to assume that it's going to happen is like folly to me.
To me, that's just inexperience. Like anybody who's been doing this for more than 5 minutes, just
knows. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
Yeah,
So, and then what happens is that the system that you're supposedly creating, people are just, because the one thing about film and visual effects people is they're highly adaptable. Mm-hmm. This is something.
Early adopters too.
But they're extremely flexible. There's a book that I like called The Meltdown, Why Systems Fail. And they look at film crews and their redundancy components so that like the film will not fail because they have, and it's the same in VFX. You have, you know, your supervisor goes down, your lead steps up, your lead goes down, your senior artist steps up, your senior artist goes down. You know, it's like there's a consistent like attitude of this will not go down. Whereas some operations would just be like, I don't know what to do, but like film doesn't work that way. You just keep going and do whatever you need to do. Which is kind of cool if you think about it. But anyways, so this idea that you can create these kind of perfections traps to me is bizarre. And what happens is everybody just ignores you and works around it. So the thing, as I've seen this before, where the owners think something's happening and you're like, and most people won't tell them, but I'm the type of person that tells them. And they just can't believe it. Like, I'm like, you think this is happening, but it's not, because I'm doing something. I'm in the background doing something different. I'm making deals with this guy over here. And we're working around your system. And to me, it's okay to work around it occasionally, but if you're working around it consistently, then the system's not working.
Yeah, that's fair. Actually, I have a question for you, which is kind of related to this end bidding. Do you think we're going to see a renaissance of the generalist artist? Because I feel like it's been in and out of vogue at different points.
Yes.
Do you think technology is going to allow for the generalist resurgence?
I thought that when we hit virtual production stuff, because the people that thrive in that is the people who can do multiple things. Mm-hmm. And the AI successes that I've seen are people that maybe not full generalists, but they're generalist oriented or not against it. And like, you know, I'm old enough to, everyone was a generalist at the beginning because there was no departments. Maybe in animation there was, but that's been a transition from traditional 2D animation with the 3D tools. And so they just use that system to adapt their sort of crews. But I do think there's going to be specialists for sure. But I think, you know, even in animation where it's fairly rigidly pipeline, the last 8 months of work that I've done in animation has been me coming from a VFX generalist shop background, encouraging and coaching people to become generalists, even though they're like texture artists. And with the, again, back to the sort of this resource thing is I can keep you on the show longer, which is better for me.
Totally.
And better for you, but a little challenging for you and a little challenging for me. So if we overcome these challenges and it gives everybody agency and you know, because otherwise it would be like, you have 4 days to complete this thing and then you are gone. Or yeah, I can say, if you can do this other stuff, I can keep you for 3 weeks and we can kind of figure it out more generally what we need to do every day. And, you know, in those short sprint animation shows I've been doing lately. It's sort of like the culmination of all these ideas. It's like, okay, we're responsible for creating the idea. We've created and pitched an idea. We've said, this is how much it's going to cost. We have a framework from a bid, but then we have to implement it. And sometimes what we planned works, sometimes it doesn't. And the more flexibility you can build in, which is hard to bid for, the more likely it's going to be successful. And then, you know, it makes it difficult for artists at sometimes and way easier at other times. It means, like, you know, if I could hire one lighter and someone else can do lighting and they're not in texture, say, for example, and they're not busy, they can help out. You know, and so it ends up being, I think it ends up being more collaborative. I think it's difficult to do at scale. I think, you know, I've heard from people, it's hard to integrate a generalist department into a big machine that is departmentally segmented. Like, different companies have had different levels of success with that, but, and that comes down, it's hard to bid. That's the problem.
I've seen pools of generalists in big studios work. I personally think that the era of the big studios kind of going away anyway, yeah. And that the smaller, leaner, meaner studios are going to, with a technological edge, are going to succeed. So, I mean, the reason I bring up the generalist thing is, I just, getting back to departments being idle, like, front of pipeline is always the hardest. Like, you need assets if you're going to be a CG studio.
Yeah.
And they are the first to get engaged on a job, which is always good for the accountants.
Yeah.
But they're also the first to get wrapped. And so if, you know, you don't get that next job that goes into assets, it can create a cost that, you know, weighs on the studio until that next CG asset job rolls in.
It can be worse than that too. If you're like, cause a lot of companies now have reverted to contract to contract.
Yeah.
And some quite aggressively. Yeah. The company I was working for, we were talking like two to six week contracts.
Yeah.
So if you say this person wraps in 2 weeks and then the next day you need someone to fix a model, you better have someone who can fix a model.
Yeah, for sure.
Or likewise, maybe if they can texture, you keep them an extra week so that there's an overlap, or they can do environments or whatever, layout. So this is where it's like, it's not just it's a flexibility thing, but it's also like a risk management strategy as well, to have the support that you know, a lot of the companies I worked for lately, they're coming in with the assumption of, like, 5 years ago, especially the management, because they're a little bit behind, where, and that makes sense, but, like, basically, like, oh, well, we can bid really aggressively and have people come in and off of shows, which we can get into in another episode. I think this is going to be a multi-part episode. you can get into people coming in and off shows, and if you have lots of work, that works. But if you have no work, they go off a cliff. And then they either sit idle, yeah, or they disappear because they either find their own work or they get laid off or their contract's end or whatever. And you can get to a point where you literally have no one in that department working in the studio. And
idleness is a killer for profitability. And it's like, yeah, you know, particularly when you have these 1 year contracts, which are great for individuals, but they're terrible for the company in the long run, and were largely a function of rewarding your best employees, but then became kind of routine, I would say. And now, as Chris is saying, if we're getting 2 to 6 week contracts, you know, if you're an asset person, already assets is largely exposed to the AI replacement. Like, there's already TurboSquid and all these online inventories of libraries of assets. And now AI can build a bicycle or GAC or things like that that used to keep people busy. So if, you know, in order to be able to do the more elaborate stuff, the creatures and the funky spaceships and the unique designs, that's I think what the new asset person is going to be doing. But if that person can also light so that they can do pre-comps, like, suddenly their lifespan on a project is vastly improved, right? Yeah. And I don't think every generalist needs to be able to do everything, but if you can do assets and lighting or texture and lighting, like,
rocket science used to be, what's your major, what's your minor, right? Yeah, you have a major and a minor, you can probably work with that.
Yeah.
And then if you have a third thing you can do, great. Because I mean, realistically, you know, some people are going to be great at one thing and okay at another, and that's okay. Yeah. But okay with someone else who is great at it is, you know, helpful.
Oh, 100%.
Anyways, so we'll end it there for this one. we will talk about this more. I think we talked, I want to get more into the specific philosophy, the technical philosophies, and then into the bids. But I think the main takeaway from this starting episode is there's a different level of pressure on these bids at the macro level that I don't think people understand. They may understand it and they may resent it, but it's the reality of their working or not. You know, companies that don't get bids don't pay employees. Companies that do bad bidding all the time suffer. People who, you know, you balance it out. Like I've heard the an adage in the past where it's like the first one you discount, the second one it's at cost, the third one is at profit, and the fourth one is you raise your costs. You know what I mean? So it's those kind of ideas that are at play, and depend how they affect you on the floor is a little bit dependent on the management decisions that are made, perfectly or imperfectly, as the case may be. But they're probably based in some reality, whether you like it or not. So let's end it there. And then we will be doing a little bit of weird episodes, like small ones like this one, because I'm out of town.
World Cup hiatus.
World Cup. Go Canada. And we already got 1 point. Here we come. We're going to win it. And yeah, so we'll be randomly putting out stuff, and I'm sure over the summer we'll get a little sporadic as well, but we'll try to keep the conversation going, and we will keep talking about bidding because I think it's important that other people understand, particularly artists understand the context of the stupid things we're asking you to do sometimes, or the perfectly reasonable things that you should do faster, those things as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyways, okay guys, have a good one, and we'll see you soon.
Bye for now. Bye.